myself. I'm sorry I wasn't there. It's just that... He pointed back toward the brook. There's a comfortable patch of clover near the water. It's an excellent spot to relax and think. He tucked the small book and pencil into his pocket and turned those fabulous eyes to me.
And you must be...
I blinked away my awe. Katrina. Van Tassel. His face suddenly came alive.
A relation to Baltus Van Tassel?
Yes, he's my father.
I have to say, I'm extremely grateful to him.
We're grateful as well, Elise blurted. Her cheeks blushed when she realized she'd said that aloud. But then, I'd be grateful too if I weren't planning an escape on Martin's ship. She quickly regained her composure and slowed her words. It's a pleasure to meet you. His eyes sparkled like the glimmer on the brook.
Likewise. Come, let's go inside.
The trees were alive with birdsong as he accompanied us back to the school. Or maybe that was my heart singing. It took tremendous willpower to keep from staring, while questions whipped through my mind. What's it like in Connecticut? Why do you trade it for the dullness of Sleepy Hollow? What were you writing in that notebook? And how did such an adorable creature as yourself end up with a name like Ichabod? Ugh, there's not even a suitable nickname for that. I was hoping Elise would blurt out some of these for me, but she kept her remarks to the weather.
That was safe territory for her.
Once inside the school, Ichabod spotted the basket we'd left on his desk. He plucked up one of the ruby apples and cocked a brow.
An apple for the teacher?
Fresh from our orchard, Elise bragged. Her flaxen lashes batted like moth wings. I nudged her foot with mine. She kept a tight smile as she nudged back. Ichabod polished the apple on his rolled sleeve, then brought it to his mouth.
Goodness! If everyone here is this generous, I'll have no regrets leaving home.
Juicy bits sputtered as he crunched down. Elise giggled like a 5-year-old, but his remark brought back that niggling question. Why did you leave? I asked. I hadn't meant to be so forward. But honestly, why would anyone as young as he want to live here? Elise, still keeping that tight smile, lightly nudged me with her elbow. Cat, maybe we should let him get settled before we start hurling personal questions.
He waved it off. I don't mind. The truth is, Hartford was closing in on me. I was needing a little peace and quiet. I've found there's plenty of that. I think I'll thrive well here.
Unless the horseman takes a fancy to you. He sat down on the corner of his desk and held the basket out.
Would you like to share?
Elise politely declined. I, on the other hand, took one of the blackberry muffins. I nicked off a tiny bite as I glanced about the schoolroom. He certainly appeared earnest. The rows of desks were uniformly aligned, a copybook atop each one. On his desk were the stacks of books I'd earlier pushed aside. I stepped by him and drew two of them toward me. Gulliver's Travels and Robinson Crusoe. He twisted around to see.
Those will be part of the studies.
I love these books, I said, pinching off another taste of my muffin.
You've read them?
He leaned close enough that I could smell the tang of apple on his breath. My stomach fluttered faster than Elise's eyelashes. My father has an extensive library, I answered, trying to stay focused. And since I've traveled so little, books have always been my escape.
No better holiday, he said.
I beg to differ. Elise nudged between us and picked up a small book the color of red clay. The title, imprinted in gold, read, The Thousand and One Nights, Persian Tales. Her face brightened. I've heard of this one. She ran her hand across the cover. The stories are quite exotic.
And adventurous, he added.
Adventure, she purred. Yet hardly teaching material, I said. His face blushed an adorable pink.
No, that one is part of my own collection.
I couldn't think of one man in Sleepy Hollow who'd own a collection of exotic, adventurous tales. None that they could display on an open shelf, anyway. Other books on his desk included the Iliad, Candide, and Don Quixote. Impressive. Our new schoolmaster was indeed well-read.
but then another book caught my eye. This one tattered from use. Clippings of paper bookmarked many of the pages, and the binding was broken and loose. When I reached for it, he fumbled, racing to pick it up first. Too late. It was already in my hand. He dropped back like I'd done something hurtful. I held the book carefully, for fear it might fall apart. The cover contained a vile sketch of horned beings dancing among flickering tongues of fire as slithering snakes coiled around their naked bodies. The title, stamped in small print, read, New England Witchcraft. I instinctively touched Simon's talisman, still hidden inside my bodice. Ichabod squirmed, and I knew this was not a book I was meant to see.
That one, too, is personal.
Ah, have I uncovered an evil secret behind those beautiful eyes? You've spent a good deal of time with this book, I said, handing it to him. Do you believe in the black arts? He opened a drawer and quickly slipped the book inside.
Yes, very much.
My eyes were drawn to the pocket of his waistcoat and the notebook he'd concealed. I was now more eager than ever to know what things he'd written inside. Again, Elise stepped between us. Then you'll love Sleepy Hollow. It's always been a place of specters and spirits and the supernatural.
Really?
He said, his confidence returning. Before she could open her mouth again, I quickly nudged her foot. Ichabod, I'm sure you'll hear all kinds of wild tales. The people here are quite superstitious. He set the apple down and dusted his hands.
All based on intriguing lore, I'm sure.
Don't be too sure. I sensed more damaging words bubbling from Elise, so I quickly hooked my arm through hers. I fear we've taken up too much of your time. We should let you get back to work. His eyes settled on mine and held.
Not at all. It's been a pleasant distraction.
I swear, his enticing gaze could melt bronze. Enjoy the treats. I still held Elise close, urging her toward the door. Wait, she said, slipping her arm free. Once again, she batted those lashes as she addressed him. My family would like you to dine with us this evening. You can meet my two brothers. They'll be students of yours when the school reopens.
I'd love to,
he answered, his voice soft.
And you can tell me more about the legends of Sleepy Hollow.
She trembled with glee. Come at 6. We're the farm closest to Van Ripper's.
I'm looking forward to it. And thank you again. It was a pleasure meeting you both.
Though he'd addressed the pair of us, his eyes locked with mine. My God, you're amazing. It took every ounce of strength I had to walk out that door.
And we thought he'd be an old toad, Elise said as we rode away from the school. She leaned back and took one of the muffins I'd set aside.
Wait, I reached for it. Aren't those for our trip to the river?
She giggled like a giddy child.
Cat, really? After seeing Ichabod? Do you really want to spoil that image by staring at those boys on the dock?
I answered by grabbing the other muffin.
I can't believe it,
she said, gazing dreamily at the azure sky.
His every feature was perfection. Hair, eyes, mouth,
and, she placed her hand to her heart,
that charming smile?
Captivating was the word I'd use. She sighed so heavily that loose crumbs fell onto her skirt.
I really must thank your father for bringing us such a delicious schoolmaster.
I laughed. I'm sure delicious was not a requirement, though it was a benefit. Her head was so far in the clouds I didn't think she'd even heard me.
I have to get home and pick out a dress for dinner.
A spike of jealousy stung me. It was my father who'd hired Ichabod. Why weren't we the first to invite him?
But I'm sick of all my plain old frocks.
She swept the crumbs from her dress as she pouted. Then she whipped toward me.
Cat, you have a beautiful wardrobe. May I please borrow one of yours?
She leaned close, her hands in prayer position.
Please?
That spike of jealousy became a spear. But then I wondered, why should I even care? My sights were on the open Atlantic and wherever Martin steered us. You don't have to beg. Her face lit once again.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
While I didn't want to dump ash on her glowing passion, I couldn't help but be curious. How do you feel about that book? She turned back to me, eyebrows knitted. Which book? That book of witchcraft? He'd read it cover to cover. Many times. Like he has an obsession. She waved it away. Interest, not obsession. He grew strangely uncomfortable when the subject came up. Elise's smile returned. Then tonight, I'll make sure it doesn't come up. There will only be laughter and enjoyment. In a village threatened by a murdering ghost, I hoped that would be so.
Chapter 6.
It was in church on Sunday when I saw Ichabod again. The pews were filled, and he sat just on the edge of the second row, hymnal and Bible both resting on his lap. Well, Ichabod, you haven't burst into flames. Maybe I'd misjudged your interest in witchcraft. I searched about for Garrett, but he was not there. I thought surely he'd find refuge in the church. His father sat among the elders, and though his brown suit was pressed and proper, his face had more wrinkles than an old hound. I vowed no matter what, I'd visit the DeGraff home this afternoon and speak with Garrett myself. I ached to know how he was doing. Reverend Bushnell preached a lengthy sermon, but I barely noticed. My eyes were on Ichabod. When he rose to sing, his fingers traced along the words in the hymnal. And with each hymn, his voice grew louder. Either he was trying to fit in or out-sing Mrs. Twiggs, who, in spite of the hymnal, always got the words wrong. When the last prayer was finally delivered, I searched for Elise. I had to know more about his visit at dinner. The only word I'd gotten from her was a note she'd sent by way of her younger brother, Dirk. It simply said, "Delicious." I had just reached her when Hanny Van Wart interceded. "Come, come, 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 come," Henny insisted, herding us to a corner near the front. Elise and I pushed in next to Sally Groot and Gertie Maris, who cradled her infant son. Henny fidgeted like a fly caught in goose grease. "I have such news of our newest resident, I thought I might burst. Had I perished halfway through the sermon, I would have found a way to resurrect myself so you good ladies would not be kept from this vital information." "Henny," I started.
"Shh,"
she blustered.
"It turns out our schoolmaster left his native Connecticut just in the nick of time. Had we not offered him a position here, heaven knows where he'd be. Probably tarred and feathered, still dashing away from an angry mob."
Gertie's jaw dropped.
"Why?"
Henny barely took a breath before continuing.
"He hails from Hartford, you see, a city that circulates several newspapers and periodicals. Using an assumed name, he published a lewd serial in one of the publications."
She lowered her voice.
"Tales of debauchery."
Sally and Gertie gasped. I, on the other hand, was more intrigued than alarmed. Their amazement only enlivened Henny.
"Each week it featured horrific topics that glorified all manner of vulgar behavior. When the upstanding citizens of Hartford learned that it was he, they literally chased him out of town with cudgels and pitchforks. I dare say he ran all the way here."
I tried to visualize a gathering of city folk with pitchforks. Absurd. Elise bubbled with anxiety.
"What types of things did he publish?" "Dreadful things," Henny answered, placing a hand to her heart. "Tales of smugglers, gamblers, prostitution."
"And don't forget my favorite,"
came a soft voice behind us. I turned to see Ichabod leaning against the pulpit, his eyes bright with amusement.
"A particularly engrossing piece that involved men dressed in women's apparel. Quite shocking."
Henny gasped, her face turning one shade darker than a turnip.
"I dare say."
"It provided me extra money while studying at the university. You should consider publishing, Mrs. Van Wart. I'm sure you could produce a riveting weekly scandal sheet."
I gulped back my laughter and could see Elise suppressing a grin as well.
"I would do nothing of the sort,"
Henny said.
"I am not one to indulge in such tasteless behavior."
She hitched her head high, nose in the air.
"Come, ladies."
She turned and stormed away. Sally and Gertie lingered a moment, then awkwardly followed. Elise and I erupted into fits of giggles. "Sorry," I sputtered, covering my mouth with my hand.
It's just that no one ever stands up to Henny.
Was any of that true? Elise asked, her eyes anxious and starry.
Yes, he answered, a little more timid. I published a lot of stories back home. I raised a brow in question. Tales of debauchery? His playful smile melted my heart. That would depend on how you define the word, but no, nothing like Mrs. Van Wart suggested. He leaned close. And none of my heroes would be caught dead in a corset. That conjured an intriguing image. So, no pitchforks? He looked down at the seat of his breeches. No holes. No pitchforks. I held up a finger. For all we know, you could just be a fast runner. He lifted his foot and looked at the sole of his shoe. Nope.
But what kinds of stories did you publish? Elise asked, fawning.
This he answered with a fair amount of pride. Tales of courage, love, adventure, rogues and risk-takers, rubes and royalty. My mind is overrun with fantasy. Elise swooned over his every word.
Much like those Persian tales?
My stories are quite different. Perhaps I could share one with you the next time I visit your farm. She clutched her hands together, beaming.
I'd love that! We could have you back before week's end.
Perfect. He then turned to me, his eyes dancing beneath his dark lashes. There's one particular story of mine that might interest you, Katrina. I could bring it this evening.
This evening?
Yes. He pointed toward Father, grumbling with the councilman in their usual corner. Baltus has invited me to dinner. I worked to keep my composure.
That's wonderful. I look forward to it.
Here was my chance to learn if he was a rogue or risk-taker. Elise's jaw tightened.
How lucky you are, she gritted her teeth, to be the first to enjoy his work.
If her teeth ground any tighter, they'd shatter from her mouth. And if that wasn't enough, she daggered me with her glare as well. Before I could reply, Martin approached, head lowered. This time he wore appropriate attire.
Katrina, I must speak with you.
He spoke quietly, but I detected a sense of urgency in his tone.
Please don't tell me our plans are off.
Privately,
he added. Elise suddenly relaxed. Delighted, I'm sure, that I was leaving her to a full helping of Ichabod.
Excuse us, I said.
Martin led me behind the pulpit. Once out of sight, I gripped his arm.
What's happened? Has the purchase fallen through?
Shh.
He shook his head.
No, not that.
I exhaled relief.
It's Garrett, he said. I've been to his house twice this week. He won't see me.
Martin and Garrett were the closest of friends. I could see Garrett turning anyone away but him.
Has he indicated why?
I didn't mention the horseman, though I was sure Brahm had informed him of Garrett's encounter.
No, but I think he's panicked.
What I saw at the meeting that night was more than panic. It was pure madness.
Have you spoken with his father?
He says Garrett's extremely ill. Dr. Goodwine is calling it hysteria. Daily bloodlettings haven't helped, and they've tried all manner of vinegars and drafts.
He looked at me as though I'd have a solution. There was one unspoken question between us.
Has he told them of the horsemen?
Martin shook his head.
I don't think so.
Why not? After what happened to Mr. Devenpeck, surely they'd be looking for a way to help him, not cure him.
Martin moved in close, his voice low.
Katrina, do you believe him? That he truly saw the horsemen?
Why wouldn't I? Why would there even be a doubt?
It's possible that he ate something disagreeable and Devenpeck's death triggered a hallucination.
He ate something disagreeable?
Oh, Martin, listen to yourself.
But there are cases of people who've become hysteria just from ingesting bad grain.
And there are cases of people who were bewitched and murdered just like our former schoolmaster. Garrett has somehow attracted the wrath of the horsemen, and we must do what we can to help him.
Martin stepped back, giving in, but the worry never left his face. I placed a hand on his.
Listen, I'll ride out to his place this afternoon and persuade Notary de Graaf to let me in.
Martin leaned close, eyes narrowed.
Katrina, that could take some bewitching from you.
It was well after 3 before I could sneak out undetected
Being a Sunday, I knew Brahm would not be near the stables. He only abided by the Sabbath when it came to work. I took every precaution not to encounter him. I quietly saddled Dewdrop and rode away. A scattering of cotton clouds dotted the sky. The scent of pine and spruce filled the air, and the chattering of woodland creatures accompanied me. Had this not been such a grave endeavor, I would have relished the afternoon sun on my face. The fall air was cool, normal for this time of year, but as I approached the DeGraff home, I gaped. At present, the trees of Sleepy Hollow wore an array of autumn colors, a blending of lime, jade, ash, gold, and coral. But the trees on their property were barren and dry, as though they'd been embraced by some pestilence or blight. Their rotting limbs resembled skeletal fingers, all pointing toward the house, the horseman's handiwork. The grass had also succumbed to some unnatural plague. Withered and scorched, it looked as though fire had rained down upon it. What must the notary think? Dewdrop slowed to a canter as we neared the property line. "Come on, girl," I said. She stopped, refusing to take another step. I snapped the reins. "Make haste!" She remained firm, nodding and braying distress. "Fine, then." I dismounted, intending to lead her the rest of the way, but she fought, pulling back and nearly dragging me to the ground. Her ears pricked, and her black eyes grew wild with fear, arousing a sense of dread that rippled my flesh. But I couldn't turn back. Garrett was enclosed in this hellish terrain. I had to see him. I towed Dewdrop back to one of the living trees. "You're just making this more difficult," and secured her to a limb. She wrestled with the branch. It felt more like a warning than an attempt at escape. Animals sense danger. I quickly turned away, refusing to heed. It was only 50 paces back to the DeGraff property, but one step into it and, holy God, the air grew bitterly cold. I pulled my shawl tighter around my arms, wishing I'd worn wool instead. There'd been no forewarning that the horseman had left his mark upon the climate here, too. I walked in haste, drawing closer and closer. The house itself looked the same. The small salt-box structure stood firm as always, the paint and trim unmarred. The dark smoke of the chimney disappeared into the graying sky. As I reached the porch, I noticed a medicinal wreath on the door, no doubt placed there to ward off disease. But rather than green and aromatic, the sprigs appeared to have been touched by flame. Whatever it meant to keep out had burned its way through. With a trembling hand, I tapped lightly on the door. Within moments, Notary DeGraff appeared, his waistcoat unbuttoned and his shirt hanging loose. He looked woefully weary, as though all strength had abandoned him.
"Katrina, we were not expecting you."
"Many pardons, Notary. I'm here to see Garrett." How foolish of me not to bring a gift, mutton soup or sweet cakes, something to show my goodwill.
"You know that Garrett isn't well. He cannot receive guests."
"I am aware, but this is urgent." He narrowed his gaze.
"In what manner?"
Since the only urgency was my desire to talk to Garrett, I had to pull a reason out of thin air. Then I remembered the talisman that Simon had made for me. I uncovered it from my bodice. "I have brought him this." The notary reached out and touched the carved trinket, running a finger across the spiral.
"Very intricate. Is this some rare charm?"
"Yes, sir. It is for health and protection. Other men in Sleepy Hollow might scoff at such a thing, but the kindled wreath on the door told me that the notary was a man of superstition."
"That's very generous of you, Katrina."
He held out his hand.
"I shall deliver it to him with your good wishes."
"I wish to deliver it myself." I spoke as calmly as possible, trying to hide my panic. He briskly shook his head.
"That's not possible."
"Please, I'll take no more than a minute." He began to slowly close the door.
"I should be attending, my son. I'll give him your regards."
"Wait!" I removed the talisman from my neck. "Here." The notary gave me a disheartened smile.
"This is very kind of you."
And with those words, he shut me out. I stepped off the small porch,
my spirits low. It made sense that Garrett would close himself away from the horsemen, but close out his friends as well. The whistling wind whipped across the property. It was like cold fingers raking my flesh. I heard my name whispered within the gust.
Katrina.
And felt his pale breath upon my neck. Or had it just been my imagination, stirred by the bleak surroundings? I hope. Anyone else would have ridden straight home, but it was my stubborn nature that guided me. I quietly slipped around to the side of the house, tiptoeing toward the back. I lingered in the chill with the presumption that the notary would deliver the talisman to Garrett straight away. How long he'd remain, I could only guess. I had no sense of time, it being void here, and let instinct guide me. I pressed myself to the wall and ticked off seconds in my head. 1, 2, 3. With my eyes closed, the stale air reeked stronger. It clung to my skin, and I could taste it on my tongue. But I wouldn't lose count. 35, 36, 37. Something brushed past my ankle. I jerked aside, shaking my skirts. What in the name of... The ground moved. It spiraled and churned like the inner workings of a clock. How was that possible? My heart pounded as I knelt for a closer look. Oh, God. I leapt back, clapping my hands to my mouth. Snakes, masses of them, brown and speckled like barren soil. They moved chaotically, weaving about with no sense of direction. Their tongues flickered, their bodies coiled. Two fought over a field mouse, still squirming for its life. Another had swallowed its own tail. With my hands still pressed to my mouth, I will not cry out. I treaded gingerly through them. Then, finding my footing, I crept around to Garrett's window. He had not exaggerated the horseman's mark. It ran diagonally through the center of the pane, raven black, with eyelash-thin cracks branching from it. My need to see Garrett pushed me forward. I rapped once, quickly jerking my hand away. It was like tapping the surface of a frozen pond, burning my knuckles. I wrapped my hand in my shawl and knocked again. Garrett, I called through the glass. Come to the window. I waited, my heart ticking the seconds. Garrett. I saw movement behind the curtains. Slight, but there nonetheless. I tapped again. This drew him over. He lifted the curtain just enough to peer out. His eyes drew to the horseman's mark, and he pulled back. Meet me at the other window, he said. I rounded the corner to the one facing the back of the property. Garrett was already there, his pallor practically transparent, and his eyes baggy and red. The talisman hung from his neck. He lifted the window just enough that we might speak without strain. His gaze shifted beyond me, looking left and right.
Go, Katrina. It's not safe here.
Why have you not told your father of the horsemen? He winced, drawing back.
This is not your concern. Please leave. I couldn't bear it if you came to harm.
Why must he be so stubborn? Garrett, simply confess your encounter. Measures will be taken to keep you safe.
I can't. And besides, I've already made my own plans.
What plans?
He hesitated, eyes shifting again.
I'm refusing the bloodlettings to gain strength.
Then I'll sneak out and ride away. The horseman only keeps to this vicinity. He won't pursue me outside the hollow. Garrett, I've an even better idea. Speak with Martin. He's purchased a ship. He and I are going to sail away. You can come with us.
His weary eyes grew wide.
Martin bought a ship?
Yes, I said, now smiling. It will be here in a few weeks and...
Weeks?
His shoulders sank, and he raked his fingers through his matted hair.
Katrina, I won't last that long.
I feared he was right.
Please, Garrett, there has to be something I can do to help you.
You can help me by staying quiet.
But...
No one must know. Now leave.
After all I'd risked, it'd been a fruitless attempt. There was no reason to continue pressing him. Very well, but I do hope you'll change your mind.
I won't.
He reached for the talisman.
You should have this back. You'll need it more than me.
No, I said, shaking my head. You keep it, to protect you until you're safely away. He clutched it in his hand.
Thank you.
Our eyes held for a moment. Then he said,
Go, before you're discovered.
I stepped away, tightening my shawl.
Katrina.
I turned.
Be careful.
With those words, he closed the window.
Chapter 7.
Garrett's deathly face haunted me all the way home. I told myself there was nothing more I could do, and I kept repeating it as I counted down the minutes to Ichabod's arrival. I was weak-kneed with anticipation, yet determined to remain level-headed. Still, I changed out of my church dress and into a shimmering violet gown with silver trim. What's wrong with a little dazzle to brighten the evening? Stepping out into our piazza, I breathed in the evening air. The western sky blazed with streaks of spun gold and deep burgundy. What a contrast to the environment of Garrett's surroundings. How would this sunset look through his eyes? A boy in hell. A boy marked by the horsemen. A hand touched my shoulder, and I blanched.
Jumpy, are we?
Brom! I clutched my fists to my heart. Don't sneak up on me like that. How did he always appear out of nowhere?
He arched an eyebrow. I wasn't sneaking. You were in a daze.
I brushed his hand away. Still, Brom had dinner with us every Sunday evening, although I'd wished tonight he'd gone carousing instead. He puffed his chest and rocked back on his heels.
So, tonight we dine with the Honorable Mr. Crane.
Honorable being the pertinent word, I said. Try to behave yourself, if you're capable.
I promise to not lick the mutton drippings off my fingers.
I was referring to your sharp tongue. He grinned and pulled me close, nuzzling his lips to my neck.
I shall be a proper gentleman.
I unwound his arms from my waist. Then start now. He stepped back, laughing like a fool. I would have kicked him had I not been worried about losing the bow on my slipper. The clip-clop of hooves echoed softly from the road. Momentarily, Ichabod approached, on what appeared to be the most cussed of all horses. It shambled forth, flicking its tail and flaring its nostrils. As they neared the hitching rail, the Dapple stopped, backed up, and circled clockwise, twice.
Steady, Ichabod said, patting the animal's smoky mane. Quite the cavalier,
Brom whispered. I poked him with my elbow. Ichabod dismounted, and with a little goading, led the horse to hitch.
Meet Gunpowder, he said, patting the horse's hindquarters.
Brom lifted a brow.
Looks as though he's lost his spark.
In several long strides, Ichabod joined us on the piazza.
I can only assume by his name that he'd had spirit in his day. Now it's purely spunk. Van Ripper loaned him to me with the assurance that an ornery horse is better than a mile on foot.
His raspy imitation made me giggle.
Well, you certainly showed that beast who's boss,
Brom scoffed. Ichabod, being the only gentleman present, ignored the comment and turned his attention to me.
Katrina, you look radiant this evening.
Judging by his fitted suit and teal waistcoat, I could say the same for him, but then he could wear sackcloth and be just as delicious. Why, thank you, Ichabod. The front door pushed open, and Father stood, filling the entry.
Were you planning to leave our guest out there with the frogs and insects? We wouldn't bear of it,
Brom said with a sweeping after-you gesture. I boldly hooked my arm through Ichabod's and escorted him inside. Though Brom looked on gently, I knew deep down his soul rumbled. I didn't care. It was time to show him that our engagement was simply a product of his imagination, no matter what blessing Father may or may not have bestowed. Simon had laid a lovely table with our Delft pottery and pewter candlesticks. Brom quickly took the seat next to mine. I was fine with that. Sitting across from Ichabod allowed me the opportunity to look into his eyes and study his face. Expressions speak as clearly as words, and I wanted to know everything about him.
So tell us, Father said,
passing the soup tureen.
"Are you adjusting to our simple ways here at Sleepy Hollow?"
Ichabod lifted the dish from him.
"I am, sir. It's like a breath of fresh air. Just the change I needed."
"Too many pitchforks?" I teased. Father's eyebrows bristled.
"What a ridiculous question."
Ichabod waved it off with a smile.
"I simply needed a quiet place to clear my head."
Brom chuckled, his eyes on his plate.
"If you want your head cleared, you've come to the right place."
Father shot him a threatening look. It was imperative that we stay mum on the subject of the horsemen, even at the risk of Ichabod's neck. He turned back to Ichabod.
"I can't imagine how a schoolroom full of boisterous children could be relaxing, but we're grateful that you came."
"They're not boisterous at all. We've only had 2 days of instruction, but I've found the students quite eager."
"And what form of discipline do you impart?"
Father asked, discipline being Father's specialty. Brom stabbed a slice of mutton and dropped it onto his plate.
"Yes, tell us. Do you rap their knuckles with your ruler or paddle their little bottoms with a board?"
At the moment, I wanted to rap his.
"Neither,"
Ichabod answered without a hint of annoyance.
"I've never been a believer in spare the rod. I find communication and bargaining works best."
Father's eyes grew so wide I thought they might roll out of his head.
"Bargaining with children? That's absurd."
"Yet it gets results."
Ichabod carved into his meat, not the least bit offended by Father's remark.
"The children and I have struck an agreement. If they finish their lessons to my satisfaction, they earn a short session of storytelling at the end of the day."
Now I was definitely intrigued. "And what sort of stories do you tell them?" His mouth curled into a gentle smile.
"Ah, I contribute very little. It's the students who do most of the telling."
Brom harrumphed as he chomped his meat.
"I think a lashing would be quicker and less painful than sitting through a lot of bumbling nursery tales."
Ichabod didn't even flinch. He had far more patience than me.
"You would be surprised at the stories they've shared," he said.
Father's brow dipped.
"A lot of poppycock, I'd wager." "I've heard some intriguing accounts. Ancient sailors, savage Indians, lost gold."
His eyebrows arched as though he'd suddenly remembered.
"And of course there's a wild yarn about a headless ghost."
A thick silence sat heavy in the room. Did Father really think Ichabod could live here for more than a day without hearing of our notorious horsemen? Ichabod took a sip of wine and continued.
"They are fierce believers in the supernatural. The girls are quite superstitious and won't go near the school's root cellar. They claim the ghost of a Mr. Smet dwells there, and if they draw close, he'll burst through the doors and grab their ankles."
I couldn't help but giggle. Maybe that's just their excuse to avoid that smelly place. Brom, clearly not amused, actually nodded agreement.
"It's a wonder one of the children hasn't fallen in and broken a leg. It should be filled in."
"No,"
Ichabod said quickly.
"I have other plans for it."
His expression favored a child who might have a toy taken from him. Father paused, his fork halfway between him and his plate.
"What sort of plans?"
He was no doubt worried that Ichabod might ask for a generous donation to carry them out. Ichabod kept his eyes on his meal.
"I intend to lay a sturdy floor. I'll store water and candles and turn it into a suitable shelter against the spring storms."
Father gave a relieved nod.
"Sounds sensible." "I agree,"
Brom said, wiping his mouth with his napkin, and thankfully not on his sleeve.
"If you're determined to restore the thing, I suggest using a good cedar for the planking. It'll resist rot, and the sharp odor will offset that dampened clay smell."
His knee brushed mine as he said it. I didn't think it was a conscious gesture, but it relayed to me that he was only being cordial to win my approval. Ichabod raised his glass.
"I will."
Brom's knee pushed closer when he added,
"But that's a lot of work for one person. I could lend you one of the slaves." "Splendid idea,"
Father said. Of course he'd think it splendid. He'd rather lend a slave than part with some of his money. Ichabod froze. His breath quickened.
"No, thank you, Baltus. That's very generous, but I enjoy a bit of hard labor."
Curious. Was he uncomfortable with the offer, or did he feel he was imposing?
"But you can't cut the timber alone,"
Brom persisted. His knee pressed closer, and though he seemed oblivious, I tapped it away.
"Simon?"
he called toward the kitchen. Simon approached, awaiting instruction. Brom promptly provided them.
This Saturday, have Isaiah carry some timber to the schoolhouse to help Mr. Crane split and shave wood for planking.
Ichabod blushed as he turned from one to the other, not sure how to handle this awkward encounter.
No, really, that won't be necessary.
Brom's knee found mine again.
I insist.
Oh, Brom, if you really want to impress me, you'd pick up an axe and volunteer yourself.
Yes, sir,
Simon said, bringing the wine decanter to refill our glasses. Ichabod's eyes flickered, something formulating behind them. He then directed those lovely green eyes at Simon.
I have a wonderful idea. Why don't we work out an exchange?
The room went completely mute. We all stopped dead still. Father gripped the table.
Now you're bargaining with slaves?
Ichabod's eyes never strayed from Simon's.
You send someone to help me with the woodcutting, and I'll come by on Wednesday afternoons to teach the children.
Father slammed down his fork.
What children?
Ichabod faced him like it was only a trivial matter.
The slave children, of course.
Father's face pinched so tight, I thought it might pop.
Teach the slaves? Whatever for?
To educate them, of course.
To what purpose? They can already read scripture.
Ichabod calmly laid down his fork. But can they read well? Can they write? And what about arithmetic? Father leaned back, nostrils flaring. I sat on edge, waiting. How long would this exchange go on before Father finally ordered him out of the house? Or worse, ran him straight back to Connecticut? It was Brom who spoke up.
It's harvest. There's no time for this idiocy.
But was it idiocy? I could see the merit in what Ichabod proposed.
I'd only be keeping them for a short time. 2 hours at the most.
It's a splendid idea, I blurted. Then all eyes were on me. I kept mine trained on Ichabod. And I'd be happy to assist. Brom withdrew his leg from mine. Father seethed with anger.
There will be nothing to assist. This is lunacy.
Ichabod stood his ground. Baltus, we are coming upon new times. Emancipation laws have already been passed in Connecticut.
This is not Connecticut.
I winced. Father would toss him out at any moment. Ichabod met Father eye to eye. I'd never seen anyone with so much conviction.
Believe me, Baltus, this is to your advantage.
Our shy schoolmaster had transformed into a revolutionary. They glared in a heated match. Brom wore a slight smirk, but he nearly dropped his utensils when Father said,
All right, Crane. Since it is far easier to agree than to find a new teacher, we'll test it.
I silently sighed relief.
But,
he continued, pointing his knife,
should I smell even a hint of trouble brewing, the council will deal with you.
Ichabod didn't seem to give a hoot about the council. He quickly turned to Simon.
How many children are there?
Simon glanced nervously at Father, then answered,
7 that are of school and age. Then it's settled,
Ichabod said.
We'll meet this Wednesday.
Sharpen 7 short sticks for writing instruments, and gather them in a spot with loose soil. Simon tried to keep a blank face, but I could see a tinge of pleasure peeking through.
Yes, sir. And Baltus?
Ichabod said, facing Father again.
Are you in possession of a globe? I'm afraid mine is too large and bulky.
Father nearly choked on his meat.
I dare say you've run out of favors with me.
I quickly interceded. I have a globe, though it is covered with markings. Ichabod lifted an eyebrow.
Markings?
Yes, I've routed passages to the places I intend to visit some day. Very soon.
A lot of poppycock,
Father rumbled.
Katrina's always been a dreamer.
Brom pressed his knee hard against mine.
It's a waste of a perfectly good globe, if you ask me.
No one asked you.
Katrina will one day inherit this farm. Her duties here won't allow for much travel.
I knocked his knee away hard. Which is all the more reason to travel now.
Enough of this,
Father said. He pointed his fork at Ichabod.
Just remember, Crane. Spend your time on logic. No filling the slaves' heads with ridiculous stories or ideas of emancipation.
Ichabod reverted to the shy teacher he was before.
I shall use my time efficiently.
Clever, Ichabod. You're both a rogue and a risk-taker. Father waved Simon away, leaving us with a moment of strained silence.
Speaking of stories, I said to soften the edge in the room, you promised tonight you'd share one of your published pieces. I wanted so badly to know what sort of tales were spun in that marvelous head. He patted his breast pocket.
And I never go back on my promises.
Brahm's knee found mine again. Enough. I stepped on his foot. He blanched and cut his eyes to me. Father wavered his hand as though conducting us.
Then eat up so that we may adjourn to the parlor for brandy.
Father settled into his easy chair and took up his pipe. I chose to sit near the corner, far from Brahm and his possessive knee. Ichabod walked to the fireplace, took out that curious little journal, and removed a piece of folded newsprint. From my view, I could make out some advertisements, a dentist, paper hangings, and several lotteries, but I was far more interested in the printing on the other side. Amid the crackling of the fire and the ticking of our mantel clock, he read,
Of Fate and Fortune. Some 10 miles from the city of Easton lay a scant few acres and a modest farm. The farm stood in isolation, with only the oxen and hens for company. On occasion, the rumble of a nearby battle could be heard, for the revolution was at its peak and the upheaval vast. But the small farm was so detached, it seemed one of Earth's hidden secrets that nothing could penetrate. The farmer himself, one Philip C. Hartley, was a stout and stubborn gentleman who refused to stay separated from the comings and goings of the city. He not only rode in to sell his plump squash and leafy cabbage, but to also partake in the pleasures of gambling. Hartley's run of luck never ceased. And though he spent a good deal of his winnings on tobacco and rum, he was known throughout Easton as Fortunate Phil. But his good fortune was not due to any measure on his part, for at home he kept a wife by the name of Rebecca. She was 10 years younger, and 10 times more tolerant than her selfish, demanding husband. Rebecca was lovely and fair, but it was her gift of strong intuition that pleased old Philip most. With his prodding, she would advise him on the best days to plant, hunt, and gamble, and she was never wrong. While he rewarded her with an occasional new dress or hair combs, Rebecca was not allowed away from the farm, and with no children to keep her company, she spent her days forlorn and lonely, a prisoner in her own home. After some 5 years, Rebecca became ill. Her ivory pallor turned gray, and her face soon resembled that of a death mask. Hartley broke his own rule and brought a doctor out to attend her. No tonics eased her. No pill revived her. And so she was left to linger. Hartley grew agitated and weary. Though his sorrow seemed genuine, it was not the loss of his wife that grieved him, but the loss of the excessive lifestyle that she had afforded him. He was helpless to provide for himself. Then the fateful day came. Rebecca gazed out the window with dark-rimmed eyes. She requested the grave be dug under her favorite elm, and then, laying out her pink dress, told him that was what she wished to wear. He fell into tears. His wife, a mere ghost of what she once was, had given him her last requests. What more could he do for this woman who had been faithful to him all this time? So Hartley took up a shovel and dug. It took the better part of the morning, but soon he had a deep, clean hole, worthy of a 6-foot coffin. He thrust his shovel into the waiting mound of dirt, wiped his brow, and turned. At that very moment, a stray bullet from the war connected with his head, killing him instantly and knocking him into the gaping hole that he had so vigorously dug for himself. Rebecca, suddenly taken with a bout of vitality, removed the shovel from the mound and carefully filled in the grave. An hour later, bathed, perfumed, and wearing her pink dress, she rode away from the farm forever.
A thoughtful silence followed. I'd never felt so connected to a tale.
I was about to compliment the author when Father grumbled,
"That ending certainly had an unexpected twist."
Ichabod's lips crooked into a smile.
"It's what we call irony."
Brahm sat stiff, gripping the arm of his chair.
"And what made you choose that particular story to read?"
Ichabod took a seat near the hearth. He glanced first at Brahm, then me, then back to Brahm.
"Irony."
The shallow look on Brahm's face spoke for his mentality. But then his perception of things were about as narrow as the fireplace poker. The next 2 hours were spent on less personal topics, such as the weather, farm reports, and the rise of the Federalist Party. I spent that time observing Ichabod, his speech, his mannerisms, and how knowledgeable he was on all subjects. He seemed oddly out of place in Sleepy Hollow. What could possibly have happened in Connecticut that sent him here? When he rose to leave, Father walked him to the door.
"By the way, Crane, you may have heard. Each year I open my home for a harvest celebration. It will be on the 28th. You'll join us, of course."
It echoed more as a command than an invitation. A broad smile lit his face.
"I wouldn't miss it."
Brahm and I saw him onto the piazza. Gunpowder had managed to loosen his reins and wander some yards away. Ichabod threw up his hands and chuckled.
"I swear, if that horse were a woman, I'd marry her."
Brahm leaned against the railing, arms crossed.
"Then spend most of your time trying to tame her."
"Or keep up with her," Ichabod countered. Their words flickered in and out as I felt a sudden stirring in the air. An odd chill. Though the night was calm, a slight draft brushed my neck, prickling my skin. I held my breath and gazed into the gloaming. "He's out there, waiting."
"Katrina?"
Ichabod said, snapping me back around. I'm sorry. What did you say?" His eyes narrowed suspiciously, and then he glanced into the darkness, too.
"I said..."
He turned back.
"You have a warm and lovely home."
Oh, yes. Thank you. He could easily detect my agitation.
"Thank you. It was a wonderful evening."
He then nodded at Brahm.
"Thank you both."
As he started down the steps, I called, "Ichabod!" Something was there, lurking, just out of sight. Something or someone lying in wait. He paused, anticipating. How do I start? How do I warn him? Brahm tilted his head, annoyed. The only thing missing was an exasperated sigh. I was about to pour out the whole story of the horseman, everything from the night at my window to Garrett's near death, but then I remembered. Garrett. It's Garrett who's marked. Garrett's the one in danger. I forced a weak smile. I was wondering what time we should expect you on Wednesday. He relaxed, his smile natural and sweet.
I hope to be here shortly after 3.
Our eyes held. A little too long. If he saw some pleading within mine, it never showed. I looked away. He strode out to Gunpowder and mounted. After some goading, the horse turned. Ichabod gave us a parting wave, and they plodded off. Once he'd ridden out of sight, Brahm caught me by the waist and pulled me aside, away from the windows.
"He's gone now. You can stop gawking."
I tugged at his fingers to break his grip. "Let go." The more I pulled, the tighter he held. He grinned down at me.
"You know, Katrina, I'm a dreamer, too."
I struggled to squirm free. "I've no doubt. Probably dreaming of tavern girls." He craned back and cocked a brow.
"Have you ever seen a tavern girl?"
How could his fingers lock so tightly? "Not that I'm aware."
"There are only 2 at the River Song, and they're as lovely as Ichabod's horse."
"Brahm, release me now."
"But I haven't told you what I dream of."
I surrendered, going limp. "Tell me." I didn't think it was possible for him to pull me closer, but somehow he managed.
"I dream of our house near the river."
He nuzzled my neck.
"A side porch, maple staircase, and a large brass knocker with the head of a lion."
I gripped his ear and twisted it, hard. His eyes widened in surprise. Get this through your thick head. There will be no house by the river, and if by some miracle there were, I'd most certainly have a say in its structure.
He pulled my hand away and grinned.
Sweetheart, of course you'll have a say. You can choose the location of our bedchamber.
You are a dreamer. I kicked his shin and he released me.
Katrina, you'll never find anyone who cares for you as much as I do.
I smoothed the wrinkles from my violet dress. Molesting me is not my idea of affection.
I admit, he said, I don't have the manners and education of our Connecticut schoolmaster.
He nodded toward Ichabod's trail.
But I can certainly provide more than someone on a schoolmaster's wage.
With father's money, I spouted. The words hung for a moment. Then Brahm stepped away, his face dark.
I think you're forgetting that it's my duties as overseer that produces that money. And it's nearly doubled since Baltus put the farm in my hands.
How can I make you understand? I don't care about the money or being provided for, and I have no desire to be married. Not to you, I nodded toward Ichabod's trail, or anyone.
He stared, jaw jutted, then put his finger in my face.
You'll change your mind.
He strutted to his horse, mounted, and rode off to his cabin. Weeks, Martin had told me. Why must it take weeks? Chapter 8. I barely slept that night, still chilled by the unseen specter near our house. When I did sleep, I dreamt of the horseman, below my window. His sword, his beckoning hand. I woke twice in a fevered sweat. But Monday morning finally crept in, and like every Monday, it was candle day, a tradition Elise and I started as children. We'd spent the morning dipping candles, laughing, and catching up on gossip. Yes, even the nonsense spun by Henny. Elise arrived, gleeful and pert, bringing with her a satchel and the gown she'd borrowed. Thank you so much, Cat. She laid the dress on the bed and, floating in a daze, brushed her fingers across the emerald brocade. It's the color of Ichabod's eyes. She was right. It was a close match to those eyes I'd looked into so many times last evening. How is your dinner with Ichabod? She asked. Isn't he magnificent? He's different. To put it mildly, she fluttered her lashes and sighed. He's so handsome and gallant and delicious. Sinfully. And look what he brought me. She opened the satchel and brought out his copy of the 1001 Nights, Persian Tales. I took it from her and flipped through the vellum pages, awed by the sketches inside. Women peering through veils, men in plumed turbans, majestic palaces with spiral domes. What a generous gift. Exceedingly generous. Her mouth twitched. Not a gift exactly. He loaned it to me. But he said the tales should play to my romantic nature. Oh, he's speaking of romance already? A pang of envy pricked my heart. Not directly, but perhaps he feels it's too soon to profess his love. I suppressed a smile. Perhaps. I handed the book back, and she gazed on it with love in her eyes. Have you read any of the stories? I asked. Just the prologue. She opened to it. It tells of a king, whose name I can't pronounce. She pointed and I read. Shahryar. What a name. My tongue would stumble over it too. This king, she continued, brought young virgins to his bed each night. And then the next morning, he'd have them executed. What? That's horrific. And not exactly what I deem exotic. Wait, she pointed to another word. This woman, I read the name, Shahazad, came to him. She'd devised a plan to stop the killings. Each night she'd tell him a story, but never finish it, always leaving him curious as to what would happen next. Elise's eyes bloomed with delight. After a year had passed, the king grew to love her and her stories. He spared her life.